It's a privilege to be interviewing the world-famous interviewer, Walter Bingham. My name is Michael Rainsbury. I am interviewing Walter because he is a graduate of Bachad. So, Walter, can you tell us, how did you get involved in Bachad? And then how did you get involved in Bachad in England?
I had Zionism with a mother's milk. So it was a given that I would join a religious Zionist youth movement. So I was involved with Bachad. Brit Chalutzim Datiim. They had a Brit Hanoah in Germany. I was actually on the list to come to Palestine. It must have been the end of 37 or beginning of 38. They actually sent me on a 4 weeks agricultural training course in Blankenese near Hamburg. But the British, as you know, didn't give any certificate, as it was called. They didn't give any permits. So I got stuck. I didn't go at that time. And then came Kristallnacht, and I believe that triggered negotiations between the German Jewish leadership and the British Jewish charitable organizations, resulting in the Kindertransport. Kindertransport was a collective name, and many organizations had an input, including, obviously, Bachad. In my town, there was a Fräulein Fenschel, who was in charge of selection. She played God. But I wonder why I was selected and not my cousins. I can only imagine that it was Bachad who submitted a list of their members whom they wanted to be included. My cousins were not members. And some children went to foster parents, others came to relatives, others went into hostels, depending on their age and their connections, and I went on Hakshara with Bachad, unaware that already at that time it was Bnei Akiva. And we had several of those centers in England. I was one of the early ones who went there, and I went to a farm in Woodchurch near Maidstone in Kent, that's the county, called Great Engine Farm. And we stayed in old railway wagons. I arrived on the 26th of July, 1939, but was only there for about 3 weeks. Then I was selected for an advanced party to prepare for our final destination, which was Gruch Castle in Abergele, North Wales, the former seat of Earl Dundonald. Here I ought to really call it penultimate destination, because we were still hoping to get papers to go to Palestine. I believe it was secured by contract just days before my arrival, with the help of the late Rebecca Seif and the Balfour family. Seif, who besides her work for Youth Aliyah, was also the co-founder of Vitzo in 1922. We were collected in red buses of the Welsh bus company Crossville, and the journey took many hours. In those days, motorways were not yet dreamt of, and from a distance we could see Gruch Castle perched atop of a low hill overlooking the Irish Sea. What a magnificent place, I thought, until I went inside. Yes, there was indeed a stately oak-panelled entrance area from which a beautiful marble staircase led to the upper rooms, and there was a huge, similarly panelled hall on the ground floor, and that became our dining room, with its magnificent fireplace, which in due course we supplied with wood from the surrounding small forest. In those days, there was no problem with smoke pollution, and every room had an open fireplace. So what was so bad when I went inside? You'll justifiably ask. Well, there was no electricity and an old generator was broken beyond repair. To call the toilets WCs, water closets, would have been a misnomer because the sanitation and drainage system was severely blocked. But it was all great fun, and we were in England and no longer among the Nazis. My task was to assemble and to erect the steel beds which had been delivered in preparation for the arrival of the main party about a week later, when the castle came alive. We were about 180 boys and girls and set up a wonderful community. We had three futsot, three groups, Aleph, Beit and Gimel. I'm not sure on what basis they allocated us. I think they made a very superficial judgment on maturity. For some reason, I was in Gimel, which surprised me very much. I think they did that in a hurry. Erwin Seligman was in charge of it all, and each kvutza, each group, had its own madrich, its own leader. Erwin Seligman was in charge of Aleph. Ours was David Granik, and he organized our post-work activities. In overall charge from his office in London was Arya Hendler, who occasionally visited the castle. And our resident medical doctor was Arya's brother. The sleeping areas were segregated, girls, I believe, on the first floor and boys on the higher floor, or vice versa. Several slept in one room, according to the space. My room was in a circular tower overlooking the meadow, a daily grazing ground for sheep, and at the appropriate time of year, I could see many lambs being born. Beyond the sloping meadow was the main coastal highway, very narrow in those days, and then the Irish Sea. We had to be self-sufficient, and there was a weekly allocation of work published on a board, the Seder Avodah. All our lighting was by paraffin lamps of various types, and the daily cleaning, wick trimming and refilling and generally preparing the storm lamps that were the norm and the few bright lamps with gas mantles that lit the open areas was a sought-after job. Sawing and chopping wood was less popular but had to be done to feed the fireplaces in our bedrooms. We had a woodwork area where, among other things, they built bedside tables from wooden boxes in which some of our provisions arrived. It was necessary to have protection to get one, good connections. After having a stint of sawing wood, I was transferred to the locksmith shop, a very important task because there were many outhouses and other areas that were locked and we had to get them open without breaking the doors. To that end, I made a number of skeleton keys of varying sizes to open all the doors. And I kept them even into my marriage, until my wife, Zichrona Livracha, made me destroy them for fear of being found and thought to be the tools of my trade as a burglar. Eventually, some of us were sent to work outside, either in Mr. Reed's market garden at the edge of the large estate, or to nearby farms or locations in Abergele, our small town, where for a year I helped to print the weekly local newspaper, the Abergele Visitor.
Did Bacha make money by the people in the farm working, and then that funded the food?
I would imagine so, but I wouldn't see that. That would go to London, because in London there was Bloomsbury House, and in Bloomsbury House was all the administration of the charitable organizations that funded us. By the way, years later, when I went into the army, I put my suitcases under the roof in Bloomsbury House, and when I returned, they had gone. We arrived at Grich Castle just a few days before war broke out. One day, we all had to assemble outside the front entrance to the castle, and Arya Hendler arrived to speak to us. It was a poignant moment in the history of our young lives when he told us that war had broken out and that it'll be a long time before we will see our parents again. We were stunned, and all you could hear for a few moments were the birds twittering in the woods, until Arya continued to elaborate. We returned to the building quietly, probably each one with his or her own thoughts. Unfortunately, more than 99% of us, in fact, of all the children from the Kindertransport, never saw their parents again. Of course, all of that only came to light at the end of the war, 6 years later. Once a week, at lunchtime, it probably was Sunday, when all of us who worked outside were home, Erwin Seligman held what he called a press conference to tell us what was going on in the world.
Tell us a little bit about the religious life.
Our motto was Torah v'Avodah, so life centered around work and religious observance. So prayer services were held, as is prescribed, 3 times a day. Of course, we observed Shabbat strictly and all the Jewish festivals. The end of every Shabbat was a particular fun time when we sang and danced Torah and generally had an enjoyable time. There was, of course, a lot of free time. And if you were well in with one or another of the girls, she might agree to knit you a kippah. We had a library that also contained books in German, general German literature, many of the kind that was later banned by the Nazis, like, for instance, Thomas Mann. One of the nicest times were the Jewish festivals, but just imagine the amount of preparation and cleaning before the festival of Pesach. In the evening, there were study courses of various levels of Jewish scripture. Of course, we also had our own resident rabbi with his family. He was Rav Sperber. We lived Torah v'Avodah in the full sense of the word. Life was, for all intents and purposes, like in the early religious kibbutzim in Israel. Of course, we were all hoping that when the war ended, we could fulfill our dream and live on a kibbutz in Eretz Israel, what was then still British-controlled Palestine. One sad event happened during my turn of the backbreaking task of harvesting turnips in Mr. Reed's market garden. I saw in the distance a number of black Humber cars making their way up the stately drive to the entrance of the castle, and I soon learned that it was the police, because one of our chavarim came down with a list of the names of those who were asked to come up to the office. They were the ones who came with German or Austrian passports and were considered enemy aliens and immediately arrested under Regulation 18B, just like Sir Oswald Mosley, the leader of the British Union of Fascists, and they were sent to internment camps, some to Australia and Canada, others to the Isle of Man, and I never saw them again, until some of us met as senior citizens. Because I came with a Polish passport and had a different sticker on the back of my aliens registration book, I was classified as a friendly alien and not interned. It was ironic that the color of the passport determined our status and fate, and not the fact that we were Jewish refugee children from the Nazis. In Germany, we were hounded as Jews and as enemies of the state, and when we thought we were free from fear, most were again treated like enemies in the same categories as Nazis who worked in England. Take this example. My wife spent 18 months on the Isle of Man, initially together with Nazi women, having daily fist fights until the difference was realized and their accommodation was separated. At Grich Castle, we had a good time, if you can say that under the circumstances. Then, one day, and I still don't know why, I was relocated to another, a smaller B'nai Akiva center at St. Asaph, also in North Wales, and not too many kilometers from the castle. It was a large one-family house with many rooms called Glengower. There, I was together with a small group, not more than 10 or 12, slightly older chavarim, who came from a Hakshara center in Milail in Northern Ireland. While at St. Asaph, I worked at the car repair shop of John Glyn Jones at the nearby village of Bottlewydden. As it was an agricultural area, it was mostly forts and tractors that I helped to recondition. I know that several of the Chavarim and Chavarot from Glengower in St. Asaph subsequently made Aliyah and helped to establish Kibbutz Lavi here in Israel in the Galil. Now they've all gone to a better place. Talking about a different type of better place, as you know, I finally made it to Israel some 67 years later. And it was the best thing I ever did, besides, of course, having a family. I suppose I did make the grave mistake not to also make Aliyah at that time. But then I married and my wife loved England, so I had to stay.
It's with the Pekisha, B'nai Kiva, that happened in Griff Castle, and the story is that Aryeh Handler was late.
I have a faint recollection that a Pekisha of B'nai Akiva was held at Griff Castle, but I can't remember any details. I do remember that we had Asefot Klalit general meetings regularly, at which we could complain about the food to get perhaps a bedside table or even a better paraffin lamp. Even that one needed to have protection to get some of those things or anything else that was on our mind.
Maybe tell me about Aryeh Handler's wedding.
You bring it home to me that my memory is not as good as I thought it was. And I don't honestly remember very much about Aryeh's wedding. I know he married Henny. The ceremony was obviously conducted by our resident Rav, Shmuel Sperber. I believe Rav Sperber had two children living with us in the castle. And the oldest was Abigail. She was brought up with about six languages at the same time. It was phenomenal. Then there is Daniel. He was born in Griff Castle in 1940. Today he is Rabbi Daniel Sperber, professor of Talmud and an expert in philology, teaching at Bar-Ilan University in Tel Aviv. But he is also the rabbi of the Menachem Zion Synagogue in the Old City in Jerusalem.
What else do you remember from the beginning of B'nai Akiva?
I've already told you that sanitation at the castle was in a very sorry state. So it fell to me to try and clear the pipes. It seemed that the pipes were running down all the way down the meadow and probably emptied into the sewers on the main road or perhaps even into the Irish Sea. Well, they were blocked, so I had to find the manhole halfway down the meadow to open it to try and unblock it. And when I succeeded, some, 200 meters of blocked pipe with sewage splashed into my face. But I also had fun. When the milkman came to deliver two heavy milk churns to the building, I, who had some idea of how to drive, because my parents had a car, jumped into his van and drove around in circles.
There is a story about how the B'nai Akiva, the Bachad group, were expelled from Griff Castle. Do you know anything about that?
When B'nai Akiva was disbanded at the castle, for whatever reason, I was no longer there. Either I was in Glengower in St. Asaph, or even already in London. I do know that the castle used to belong to the Earl of Dundonald, and maybe it was leased on contract. It was all organized by the Bloomsbury House. I wasn't involved. I was just one of the children. It may have been that Erwin Seligman knew going on. What I can tell you is that even when I left to go to St. Asaph, the castle was already in much better shape than when we took it over.
Maybe just a little bit about the impact that you felt that Aryeh Handler had on Bachad, by extension, the Jewish community, and even the Jewish world.
At that time, Bachad was Aryeh Handler, and Aryeh Handler was Bachad. He was the driving force. He was the engine. He was the battery. He was everything. He organized everything as far as I could see. When, in the very late 1930s, the religious Zionist youth movement was mentioned, his name came up. I think I owe my life to Aryeh Handler. That's how I feel, because I was on the Kindler transport. There was somebody in my town who played God and was in charge of the allocation. By what criteria, I don't know. Many organizations had an input, including Bachat, so I can only assume that they submitted a list whom they want included. My cousins were eligible, but they were not members, and they were not chosen. I have a very bad memory. Some of the long-term part just faded, but I am grateful to our sponsors, because it must have cost a lot of money. Okay, I suppose when we went out to work, like I did to the local newspaper, they had to pay wages. I'm not sure where it went, I suppose to the Bloomsbury House. The only money we got was sixpence a week. That was half a shilling or a 40th of a pound. Just enough to buy a postage stamp for a letter to relatives in America, because they were not yet in the war until 1941, and perhaps a piece of chocolate, or the return bus fare to the next big town, which was Rill.
And just to conclude, maybe you could tell me a little bit about the impact that you think that B'nai Kiva and Bachat had on you and Anglo-Jewry at that time, and the role of B'nai Kiva today.
Let me answer your question in reverse order. It warms my heart to know that B'nai Akiva is active all over the world and that our Jewish youth in most corners of the world gets together in organized groups learning about the lifestyle of Torah v'Avodah while having fun at the same time. I'm sure that the work of B'nai Akiva contributes greatly to encouraging Aliyah. As far as I was concerned as a young teenager in Germany, well, I had Zionism with a mother's milk, and it was a given that I would join the youth wing of Bachat, Brit Chalutzim Datiim. It would have been maybe at the end of 1937 or beginning of 38 that I was registered to go to Palestine and join a kibbutz. They, I presume it was Bachat, even sent me on a 4 or was it 5 weeks agricultural preparation course in Blankenese near Hamburg. In German, it was called a Vorbereitungslager, but the British did not give me the papers. So, as I told you, I came to England under the auspices of Bachat, not knowing that it was already B'nai Akiva. The idea was to be in transit, first of all getting out of Germany and waiting for the papers while in England. Then the war broke out and I literally got stuck in England. About Anglo-Jewry at that time, I knew nothing, literally nothing. I want to end with these words about Aryeh Hendler. He was responsible for the whole operation of B'nai Akiva Youth Aliyah. He negotiated with our sponsors and in fact set up the various Bachat Hakshara centers. He was effectively the founder of B'nai Akiva. Interestingly, Aryeh had permission from the Gestapo, even at the very late date, to travel between Germany and England on several occasions to arrange the youth aliyah. I had the great privilege in later life to call him my friend, and when we both lived in London, just 200 meters from each other, we often met. It was also a tradition for many years that I broke the Yom Kippur fast with him and Henny. He was 8 years older than I am. I suppose at advanced age, those years make very little difference. And I often visited him after he finally settled in Jerusalem in 2006. In the annals of Israel's history, it is noted that he was the last person alive who was invited to be present at the signing of Israel's Declaration of Independence in 1948, though not as a signatory. Aryeh Hendler was an amazing person who achieved so much as a young man in his early 20s. Hundreds of us owe their lives to his efforts. He died in 2011, just a few days before his 98th birthday. May his memory serve as a blessing.
I'm sure that everyone in B'nai Akiva would join me in hoping that you continue to tell that story. And it's really inspiration meeting you. And even though we could talk about your whole life and be here for hours, just that little bit that maybe the other journalists won't cover about B'nai Akiva, but for people who come from B'nai Akiva, it's a very formative part in our history. So thank you very much.
My pleasure.